This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, last week, we talked about having a retirement investment plan that matches the type of investments and the purpose of the investment. In other words, pension, Social Security, and annuity to meet your basic needs, bonds, dividend-paying stocks for the extras. This week, we're going to talk about how to plan around a possible reduction in Social Security benefits. That's right, folks. For the first time this week over the debt ceiling debate, one of the sides talked about means testing. Talk has been around for several years on this issue, and it came up again this week during the budget discussions. So it's something you want to keep on your radar screen as you prepare for retirement. If you're fortunate enough to save enough money, well, the government may come back. Remember, at one time, Social Security was tax-free. Then it was 50% subject to tax based on a certain level of income. And then they raised it to 85% of it was taxable based on income. They may be doing something similar with receiving benefits based on income going to means testing. It was brought up in Simpson-Bowles, and it was also brought up in the Paul Ryan plan. Well, they're talking about reform again. And when they're talking about reform, you can bet one thing. They're talking about raising taxes.
So Social Security reform is the topic for the first half of the program, but in the second half of today's program, Jim and Carolyn Rosenblatt, who's a registered nurse, attorney, and the author of The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents, will be talking about strategies to talk to your parents about their finances and their health. Believe it or not, knowing how well your parents have planned for retirement is pretty critical for planning for your own retirement. You need to know if you should start planning for having a parent live with you. Maybe if you're going to have to provide care for a parent, or maybe you're going to have to financially support your parent in their later years. So your parent's financial and health condition can pretty dramatically impact your own financial and retirement planning.
No kidding. And the boomer generation has been called the sandwich generation because boomers are finding themselves in situations where they're supporting both the prior generation, their parents, and the next generation, their kids. So your retirement plan needs to include some flexibility for the boomerang parents or the boomerang kids.
And of course, all this planning can get a lot more complicated if your dependable sources of income in retirement turn out to be not so dependable. Now, I personally have about 30 more years before I can even think about retiring, and I'm really not planning on Social Security. I figure by the time I retire, you know, Social Security is either not going to be around at all, or my benefit's going to be extremely reduced from what it would be today.
Now, many of you who are approaching retirement have asked us, when should I start taking Social Security? Which, as we've discussed on the program almost a month ago, is determined by your unique situation. Everybody's a little different. For instance, what are your other sources of income? Will delaying benefits help a surviving spouse make ends meet if it results in a higher widow's benefit? And of course, people wonder about how much longer the Social Security program can be sustained.
I think this is a pretty common concern for people who are approaching retirement, Jim, or even people in retirement. Is Social Security really going to be around for me? And I think as we've seen this week with the budget talks, is that that's still kind of an iffy point. I think it'll probably still be around, but probably not in the same way that we see it today. Back in 2011, the New York Fed actually published a paper in which they outlined four different scenarios that they could see being put in place to essentially reform Social Security and make it sustainable again. And so those four options were, number one, to raise the Social Security tax by 5.7 to 6.7%. Now, I don't know about you, but that's a pretty hefty chunk of my paycheck that could be taken away from me. And I'm not sure I'm going to be all that happy about that. Their second idea was to reduce the benefit replacement rate by roughly a third, which would mean that all those getting benefits now, or perhaps those who are about to start taking benefits, would get their benefit replacement reduced by a third. Now again, that's a significant impact on your retirement situation. The third idea they had was to increase the retirement age. Now I know this has been around for a long time, and it's already happened. My generation is going to have to wait till age 67 to get full retirement benefits from Social Security. So this idea is not new, and I wouldn't say it's popular exactly, but it's less controversial than the others. Well, according to the New York Fed's research, the retirement age would have to be pushed all the way up to age 73 to make a big enough impact to save the Social Security program. That's 73. That is a long time more than 66. That's 7 more years to wait for retirement. And then the fourth option was to means test the benefits. Now, again, I really can't see a situation in which us taxpayers really raise our hands in the polls and say, yay, please tax us some more with Social Security taxes. But I can see situations in which generations like mine definitely see changes to our retirement age or to the amount of benefits that we receive. But I want to talk a little bit about this whole idea of means testing, because right now there's really two flavors of means testing that have been talked about. And the first flavor is an income test, where essentially the government takes a look at your overall income and decides that over a certain level, which right now they're postulating somewhere between $60,000 for a single person and $120,000 for a married couple, that over those limits, you would start to receive reduced or no benefits. So that's kind of the first flavor of means testing. And the second flavor of means testing, again, has to do with income. But instead of receiving a reduced benefit, if you're over certain income levels, your benefit from Social Security would be subject to higher taxation, which could mean your entire benefit is subject to income tax. Now, right now, no one is talking about asset tests as a portion of means tests. Now, Australia does that with their particular retirement program, but so far, all the means testing discussions we've been having here in the U.S. have really been focusing a lot more on the income test. But again, keep your ears open in case that asset test starts to be on the radar screen when they talk about reforming Social Security.
And that's one thing, Kathleen, one approach that's been suggested, and they've done this in terms of how they tax Social Security. And prior to the year 2000, when an individual took Social Security at, let's say, age 62, if you had earned income, they would phase out a certain level of your income based on how much you earned. And then same from age 65 to 70. And then after age 70, you could earn as much as you want. Well, that changed with the laws in 2000. So today, if you retire at full Social Security age, which for most boomers is age 66, you can make as much money as you want. One of the thoughts that I've seen proposed is kind of like the way they used to phase out Social Security income based on how much you earned. They would do the same thing. So if you have outside income, pensions, annuities, investments, based on a certain level of income, they would begin to phase out certain amounts of your Social Security benefits. So that's just an idea that's floating out there, and it's the way it has evolved over the years. But let's take a look at a situation where some of these changes are going to make a big difference in terms of planning for retirement. And I want to look at how a reduction in Social Security benefits really changes overall spending and your asset allocation plan.
So some time ago, Jim, you and I talked about the Turners. This is probably about 6 months ago. And just to refresh our listeners' memories, the Turners were a couple. Joe was about 70. He's a retired aerospace engineer, and his wife, Irene, 65, retired from a secretarial job that she picked up once the kids had all left home. And again, to refresh your memories, their budget was around $110,000, which we reduced by $12,000 to $98,000 when they sold their home in Mammoth. And they used the funds from that home sale to self-fund some long-term care with some annuity contracts. At the time we talked to them, $42,000 of their income came from Joe's pension, and $45,000 came from Social Security between the two of them. If their Social Security benefit was reduced by a third, which is what the New York Fed's proposals was to reduce the benefit by a third. So if their Social Security income was reduced by a third, that would reduce their benefit to $30,000 a year. So that would reduce their total income to $72,000 for a total shortfall with their budget of $26,000 that had to be made up from some other source, such as their investment portfolio.
Now, our plan with the Turners at the time was to split their investment assets between, let's say, a dividend-paying stocks and a laddered bond portfolio, which would provide additional income of roughly about $14,000. However, this would still leave us with about a $12,000 budget gap. Now, if Social Security was reduced by a third, so you can see the difference there by just a reduction in Social Security can make a major difference in lifestyle plans. So what are our options in this scenario? One option is to reduce expenditures. Another option would be for one of them to go to work part-time, or they would turn their condo sales money into an immediate annuity to generate income, rather than a deferred annuity to cover long-term costs. But what if those are not feasible for the Turners? I mean, everybody's a little different, and everybody wants to use different approaches to meet their retirement objectives, either increasing income, working part-time, or maybe just reducing expenses. Now, the options we presented to them before were options that didn't involve dipping into principal. However, if Social Security benefits get reduced, we need to consider this as part of their plan in the future. One option to consider is, let's say, a distribution plan that is part dividends and part principal, in other words, capital appreciation. There's other investment instruments out there that aim to do exactly this. In good years, for example, part of the income generated to you could come from capital gains in the investment when your assets appreciate. And in poor years, part of your payout will come from principal. One option we're aware of seeks a 6.5% payout rate, which is a mixture of both the dividends and principal. With $400,000 to work with, this investment would pay out $26,000 to the Turners to exactly cover their income needs. Now, another option also sells covered call options. These are sort of like options on your stocks to boost the total return on investments. Its payout rate is about 8%. It's a blend of dividends, principal, and capital gains, and of course, option premiums. Now, the Turners could put $300,000 in this option and the remaining $100,000 in laddered bonds to meet their income needs. What we're trying to illustrate here is there are a number of ways to meet your income shortfall needs. And as I said, everybody is a little different. Their situations are different, and what they're comfortable with or risk tolerances are all different. What we're trying to show here, there's more than one way to meet those objectives.
I think it's kind of important to talk about here, Jim, if we're talking about discussing with our listeners income options that include a portion of the income coming from your principal, is that you and your advisor really have to pay attention to your overall asset level, because the last thing you want to do is to spend down your principal too quickly. So from time to time, maybe you rebalance what's happening in your investments so that maybe perhaps some of the gains that you see happening in these investments gets transferred over to laddered bonds, for example, so that you consistently rebalance the risk level in your portfolio. But again, if you're looking at an option that does pay out principal, just really keep an eagle eye out on your overall principal level and your asset level, because you don't want to spend down your assets too fast. Now, in the case of the Turners, I have to say, if they're not willing to reduce their lifestyle or take a part-time job, I'd really be tempted, Jim, even though I know they have concerns about long-term care costs, I'd be tempted to tell them to transition one of those deferred annuities they had in place for long-term care costs, really tempted to tell them to put that into an immediate annuity, which would pay out about $6,000 a year for dependable income. Now, if they did that with one of their variable annuities and moved it to an immediate annuity, they could do something a little different with their $400,000 instead of put most of it in some of these slightly riskier situations that pay back a portion of dividends plus principal. So we could sort of look at doing a different situation for them. Like maybe we'd put about $150,000 in the vehicle that pays out dividend, principal, and options, which would generate about $12,000, and put the rest of it in laddered bonds at 4%, which would generate $10,000. So their income need would be covered from a blend of moving to an immediate annuity with part of their funds, and then also a blend of these principal return, dividend return, options premium return as income, and bond income as well. But I have to say, I'd really prefer that they review the role of their variable annuities in this situation rather than putting their entire nest egg into something that's going to be exposed to market risk and be at risk of reducing principal.
What we're trying to do here is illustrate the point. You can't get wedded to a lifestyle or too fixated on your investment plan. It may be that, if Social Security were reduced in the future, that the best option for the Turners would be a lifestyle change or maybe a move to a cheaper location. We're seeing that happen more and more as many areas such as Southern California or even on the East Coast get to be very expensive. But that's a quality of life versus a financial security issue that they are going to have to decide for themselves. And what we have found in working with people throughout their retirement years, sometimes what they wanted to do when they initially retired eventually changes over time, getting rid of a second home, or maybe moving to a cheaper location, or even going to part-time work. So all of that is very fluid during your retirement years. I mean, you can have a retirement plan, put it into place on the day you retire, but you may find that that plan changes over time, just as the markets have changed. I mean, take a look at what's happened to interest rates over the last 13 years. Would you have thought 13 years ago we'd be looking at T-bill rates at 0.1% or even 4% mortgages? So all of this can change over time. And Kathleen, you and I have talked all the time about the importance of having a plan, both for building up your assets, for spending them down when you retire. Having a plan makes you a little more confident because it allows you to weather the market storms, and we get them periodically. But one of the most important parts of your plan is that it needs to be flexible so that you can review and adapt it as things like regulations governing Social Security change, markets change, or even your own personal needs change over time, medical reasons. But where I want to raise a red flag, there is such a thing as too much change. Any changes to your financial plan needs to be carefully considered and be supported by rational facts, not emotions. Very easy to get emotional when the media is scaring the bejeebers out of you, whether it's the fiscal cliff or the debt ceiling. And we like to call this kind of change, change on the margin, where the core of the plan remains fairly solid, but perhaps some of the details shift just a bit, such as modest shifts among investments during, let's say, specific periods for specific reasons. Unfortunately, fear is not a reason to make a major change. It's an emotion. And without a plan for your assets, you're more susceptible to fears about a market crash, a dollar collapse, about the U.S. defaulting on its debt, which we covered over the weekend to show that that really wasn't a possibility. That was more of a media-driven fear event. Or to such things as, you recall what it was like in the late 90s, irrational exuberance. Well, we're all going to become millionaires based on our new tech economy. And think of all the people that loaded up on tech stocks in the latter part of the 90s or bought too much real estate in the last decade. The point being, when you have a plan, you monitor it, you adhere to it, and you make those minor changes, not major changes based on emotion and fear.
We still see a lot of investors, Jim, who are making decisions now based on fears coming from 2008, which is 5 years behind us now. So we still have a lot of investors that are holding on to fears that are 5 years old. Maybe they're still 100% in cash. And so all their investment decisions are still being made from a place of fear rather than a place of fact or a place of practicality. So I could maybe see where maybe being 50% cash or 30% cash, you could tell yourself that that was being conservative or being careful and have a pretty legitimate reason for feeling that way. But when you're 100% in cash, you're making a major mistake that you can do with any asset class, which is to be 100% exposed to just one investment. And folks, cash is an investment. We don't think about it as an investment, but it is. And so when you put 100% of your money in cash, you're exposing 100% of your liquid net worth to all the risks of cash, inflation, dollar devaluation, etc. So again, putting all your eggs in one basket, never wise. Doesn't matter what kind of investment you're talking about. But Jim, I want to switch gears here just a little bit and talking about money. I'm talking about money across generations, parents to kids, kids to parents. And I know this is really, really tough. I don't think that there's ever truly a really easy way to sit down and start this discussion with your kids or with your parents. Money and health are tough topics to bring up with your family. But I have to say, these conversations absolutely have to happen. Both sides of the conversation really need to feel comfortable and confident that there is a plan in place for healthcare, a plan in place for assets, and how those assets are being used, so that the burden of decision making doesn't have to happen at the absolute worst possible time and by people who don't feel qualified to make those choices. Example, making decisions about your assets or your healthcare or about your estate plan from a hospital bed is not a time when you're either A, emotionally firing on all cylinders, or maybe mentally firing on all cylinders. You're making decisions at that point from a place of stress and a place of pain and not a place of rationality. So making these decisions ahead of time, discussing one with your family, is absolutely critical. And we've talked about this before, Jim, but the more and the earlier that you share your plans and your strategies for taking care of yourself and your family with your kids, with your parents, and the earlier you share these expectations with them, the easier it's going to be to handle those tough situations when they come up, because they will.
Well, I'm glad Karen Rosenblatt agreed to be a guest on Lifetime Income, since she's been reaching out to the boomer generation about how to talk to their parents about money. She and I are going to discuss ways to start these conversations, how to add an extra dimension of security when you're planning for a retirement, and we're going to cover a lot of these tricky issues. That's coming up right after this. Joining me on the program is Carolyn Rosenblatt. She is a nurse, attorney, and mediator. She's also the author of the book, The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents, a help for those who are taking on the caregiver role in their lives. She will also be co-authoring the book, Guide to Elder Mediation. Carolyn, one of the issues that often comes up as parents age, sometimes you get into issues of dementia, Alzheimer's. There's all kinds of issues that come up. What are the most prominent issues that you see and have to deal with on a constant basis?
Well, as you know, I'm in the consulting business, so people call with questions or come in with questions a lot. And I would say that the most frequent areas of problem come from two things. One, concerns about finances, and two, concerns about the role of taking care of the aging parent.
And when you run into finances, is it they're spending down their money? All you need is one serious medical illness, and if it isn't fully covered, that can go through a bank account very quickly.
Oh, absolutely. But I think more than illness, it's really the failure to anticipate that caregiving is going to be necessary for most people by the time they get to be, say, 80, and the failure to plan for that expense. It's just something that people don't want to face.
And lack of planning, you know, this is one of the issues that we see in retirement planning. People think about putting money aside and meeting their basic living needs when they retire. So, you know, you think of mortgages, house payments, food. They don't think of long-term care or serious illness, do they?
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons that it becomes such a problem for the adult children is that the parent, even if they're starting to be impaired with Alzheimer's disease or any other form of dementia, or even if they're just becoming physically impaired, they do not want to yield control. They're terrified of giving up control over their lives. So they see addressing the issue of the possible need for caregiving, or even planning for being potentially infirm and needing someone to help them, as just awful and not something that they want to face.
Yeah, I had a client who had a parent that was in serious illness, was dying of a disease, and they had set up a trust, but she had not put the assets in the trust, which would have gone through probate. And when the kids tried to get involved and make sure that, you know, mom signed the forms to deed the assets to the trust to avoid probate, she refused to do it because she thought the kids were trying to take control over the assets. Is this something you also see as well?
Oh, yes. I've actually seen people end up having to go to court over that very thing, where they just didn't get the paperwork signed, and then the person loses capacity later on, that is, capacity for making financial and other decisions, and it forces the kids to have to get a lawyer and spend a lot of money on getting a conservatorship over them. And it's tragic. I think that certainly the parents may resist, but I do think there are a lot of things that the adult children can do to help them get to the place where they can make peace with this weird question I have, which is, you know, are they really trying to manipulate me? Are they really trying to take over? And the truth is sometimes kids are trying to take over and are trying to manipulate, but that's not most of the time.
Yeah, because we do run into cases today where you run into elder abuse, where kids are taking advantage of, let's say, a surviving spouse. We run across this more and more these days, and especially over the last decade.
Yeah, it's horrible. And I think a lot of it has to do with where the economy went, and that a lot of people who are, say, baby boomer age have not realized their hopes in terms of what they hope to accomplish financially. Maybe they've lost a job. Maybe their savings were eroded by either investments that went south or by needs they didn't expect to have. And they then are very tempted to look at what a parent has, figure somehow that they are entitled to this, and they do terrible things to parents. I have one case that I've been asked to look at now, which unfortunately I don't think I can do very much about, but this woman who's now 88 and has dementia is still living in the family home. About 10 years ago, she deeded the home over to her son because she was starting to have trouble keeping track of things. And, you know, I'm sure in her mind, he was going to take care of her at home with his wife. She could live there for the rest of her life. She wouldn't have given him the title to her home if she thought he was going to dump her in a nursing home. But that's exactly what's about to happen.
Wow. In that kind of case where it's done like that, there's not really much that can be done, is there?
Not after the fact, but there are certainly advanced planning techniques that a competent financial professional and an competent estate planning attorney can set up so that at the very minimum, the woman has a life estate in her own home and she cannot be thrown out, and that the asset that the home represents can be used to pay for whatever care she requires.
If you were to have an ideal world where you were counseling, let's say, some boomers regarding their parents, they see that their parents are getting older, aging, maybe aren't as quick-thinking as they used to be, or even worse, they see the beginning signs of dementia and Alzheimer's. How would you approach this?
The first thing I would want for adult children to understand is that they are going to have to be responsible most of the time in some way for helping their aging parents as they get older. And that is because of the infirmities that accompany aging. There are something like 5.5 million people in this country who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and that doesn't count probably millions more who have never been officially diagnosed. When the first signs appear, it's important to do the things you need to do. The first one is to make sure that you have the legal documents in place. There needs to be a trust if they own anything, a house, for example, assets, a bank account, any investments. And whatever can be put in the trust not only keeps them out of probate, but it protects the elder when they become disabled in some way, mentally, cognitively, because there is a successor trustee set up. And if that happens to be the spouse who is equally impaired, there is typically another successor, which would usually be one of the adult children, who can take over and keep that parent or those parents from financial ruin by overseeing what they're doing. That part is really important, and it requires legal planning.
And you just said a key word there, planning. And that struck me, and something we always recommend is planning. So there has to be some forethought, some planning done, because the last thing you want to do is get caught in an emergency situation, or even worse, you find something out and it's too late. And, you know, the person's incapacitated, so they don't have the legal capacity to start signing documents or do things that are necessary.
That's right. They can't sign anything once they get past the point where they're really able to understand the consequences of what they're doing. You know, it's pretty loose if you're talking about setting up a will or trust, because we call that testamentary capacity. And, you know, the courts are very generous with that. You don't really have to understand every dollar you've got. You don't have to have a clear idea about how the bank account works or the level of your mortgage. But you just have to understand generally what you have and who you want to give it to. And that's sort of oversimplifying this concept of testamentary capacity. But beyond that, there is this notion of financial capacity, which is way more complicated. And that is really about the ability to understand what you're doing with your assets, your money, your house, anything that you own, and all of the nuances of the consequences of decisions that you make. And that means being able to look at a checkbook and understand what's in it. That means being able to understand how your mortgage works. That means being able to understand that if you only have a certain amount in the bank, you cannot afford to be donating six-figure amounts to local charities because you're going to run out of money. And those are some of the things involved in this concept of financial capacity.
Carolyn, what about the idea of a corporate trustee? You mentioned the situation where a woman donated her house or put it in her son's name thinking that he would take care of her. And obviously, that's not what he did. What about a corporate trustee to sort of ensure that things are going to be done legitimately and nobody's going to be taken advantage? How do you feel about that?
I think it's fine. I think that people underutilize fiduciaries, licensed professional fiduciaries, who can serve as trustees. A lot of these estates are not so big. They consist of primarily the home and some other assets, maybe an IRA or KEO or something. But if the family can't get along or there's any doubt that the parent can trust any of the adult children who might be placed in charge, then it makes sense to use a neutral outside person whose obligation is to protect the trust assets and carry out whatever the terms of the trust are. In this instance that I mentioned, the story of this 88-year-old, the house was not in a trust. She just gave it to her son. It was a horrible move, and he has betrayed, I think, her belief in him because he is just getting ready to, you know, move in, remodel a house, kick his mother out, and gee, that's too bad because most of her cash is gone.
When you're putting together these legal documents and you're doing some planning, are there any kind of counseling advice that you could give to overcome objections? I mentioned the fact where a particular client was dying of a disease, had a trust set up, but the trust was not funded. And as the children got involved to try to get that done before she passed on, it really began sort of as an issue. Oh, they're trying to take control. Are there ways to approach this that makes it much easier and maybe takes away some of the fears?
Yes. I think one of the most important things, one of the most fundamental things, is the trust and communication within the family. A lot of intergenerational wealth transfers fail because of a breakdown of trust and communication in the family. You start with the estate planning attorney or the financial advisor or both. Each of those individuals has a tremendous opportunity to facilitate communication. And the first pushback you get on that, the lawyer says, well, my duty is to my client, and you know, I can't talk to the kids. Well, yes, you can if there is a waiver of confidentiality and if the adult, the elder, gives permission for the lawyer to communicate about the estate plan, the trust, whatever, with the adult children present, that's fine. That's a matter of communication. And the same with the financial advisor. The financial advisor is in a wonderful position to educate the heirs, the potential heirs, about what's there and help prepare them to manage it. If that managing it means getting the house set up to take care of mom or dad should they need extra help, then that's part of the education process. But I think both professions back away from these intergenerational conversations because of this privacy consideration, which to me is very easy to overcome with the permission of the person who's got the estate in the first place.
So if you're approaching a delicate situation like this, is that where someone like yourself comes in and mediates? You can come in as a neutral party to come in and say, look, really, putting the assets in the trust, getting a corporate trustee, that's really going to protect you.
Sure. That's part of what we do here at agingparents.com. I work with my husband, who is a clinical psychologist, and we not only mediate family conflicts, but we give a lot of advice. We help people who are just sort of struggling with an issue to kind of get through the hurdles that are blocking them from accomplishing the ideal outcome that they want to have. And we do that through meetings. We do that through telephone conferences. We do that sometimes on Skype, getting people together who are scattered across the country. But it is worth the investment that people make in that little bit of advice, because if you think about the cost of, let's say, the dire consequence of having to go to court and get a conservatorship, you can spend $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 in a fight over a conservatorship in this state. Whereas if you spend far less than that on getting some competent advice to help you at the front end, you're never going to have that conflict and you will not need a conservatorship.
You know, as you take a look at some of these issues, once again, it gets back to a planning issue. Most people, when they get ready to retire, they're thinking of putting money away, you know, a place that they want to live. Maybe they're going to sell the big house, buy a smaller house, move closer to the kids. Is this the time really when you're thinking of getting ready to retire to put all these issues into a plan So you've got the estate planning documents if you need, you know, you've got some kind of financial arrangements to take care of, such as a serious illness. Maybe it's Medigap insurance. Maybe it's annuities for long-term care or long-term care policy. But also there's sort of a plan of action, a step, so that let's say mom and dad live in Florida, the kids are all over the country, something happens to one spouse and surviving spouse is incapacitated. There's sort of a playbook, sort of a plan. You know where the assets are, because one of the things that we find, Carolyn, sometimes is we just went through this issue with a client where the husband handled the finances. They lived in a retirement home, which was nice. So they had the medical care, they had the finances. But after he passed away, we found assets, brokerage accounts, places where he stored bullion, bank accounts, all kinds of things that the surviving spouse wasn't even aware of.
Exactly. And that's a nightmare for people. And again, it starts with the fundamental need to communicate about what you've got, where it is, and what you want to do with it. And it has to go beyond the estate plan that the lawyer creates to the education of the family. Now, the elder who handled all the money really had a duty, if he wanted things to go well, to make sure that not only his spouse, but the adult children knew where everything was and what the estate really consisted of, and not being secretive about this, because secrecy is a great way to make sure it all falls apart and creates a problem for people after you're gone. But, you know, we're kind of a death-phobic society. We don't want to think we're going to die, and so people avoid this. And the consequence is just what you saw. It's a mess.
Is that more, Carolyn, a generational issue? I know a lot of the greatest generation were very circumspect about divulging financial information. It was kept private.
Yeah.
You take a look at the younger generations today that, my goodness, you take a look at Facebook, Twitter, they want you to know everything about them and what they're doing.
Right. But the problem is that the people who lived through the Great Depression are the ones who are now still holding some of the wealth that is supposed to comprise the greatest transfer of wealth in our country's history. So this privacy, being circumspect issue is still a difficulty. I think that elders who have money and intend to leave something to their heirs really need to have the assurance of the heirs that they're not trying to manipulate or control or force anything to happen, that they simply want to protect the parents, that they want to honor their wishes, their values, their long-term goals for whatever inheritance is intended, and that they will do what they can to assist and prevent the abuse or misuse of any part of that estate. But that conversation doesn't take place very easily, and a lot of people need help. And, of course, that's something that we do here, is to help facilitate those conversations. But I think that it's a common problem that people have difficulty in even discussing these things.
You know, the ideal situation, I would think, too, Carolyn, would be if you're setting up this plan, you've got the attorney involved with putting together the legal documents. You may have a financial planner or investment advisor, maybe sometimes an accountant if there's complicated tax issues. But it seems like the ideal thing would be to have a meeting with the advisors and the family so everybody knows they're on the same page and you can have input from various people that will be involved in the estate.
Absolutely. That's really something that we advocate. And, you know, with technology being what it is, you can have a Google Hangout, you can have a Skype conversation, you can do this by video conferencing. There are a lot of ways to make this easier for people so that you don't have to have everybody fly in from out of state and converge, although face-to-face, of course, is ideal. And if the estate is large enough that there are going to be a lot of educational needs that the heirs have to make best use of the assets, then you definitely need to have more than one meeting. The planning is really more of a process than a single event. But I think what you're suggesting, of course, is something that we are totally behind here at AgingParents.com, because we don't like to see people fail and not make it for lack of the know-how about communicating about planning and actually doing the planning itself.
Yeah, in the age that we live in now, you have, with the internet, you have things like GoToMeeting, you have Skype.
Right.
So even if mom and dad or the kids are in different states, different time zones, it's possible to bring everybody together.
Sure, and we've done that with mediation too. We had one mediation here at the office with the elder, two adult children in the room, and then three other adult children in different states were on Skype video on split screen so that everyone could see everyone and hear one another as well. And we did get that matter resolved.
If you were to describe an ideal situation in terms of planning for these kind of issues, whether it's estate planning, incapacity, final distribution? How would that process look?
I think the first thing is that the adult children may need to be the ones to initiate, because as you say, a lot of people in the Greatest Generation are a little bit hesitant about revealing what they have for fear of being taken advantage of, or because of their history. During the era when they grew up, it was not considered polite to talk about money. So if the adult children initiate a conversation about planning for the future, then they've got to pick a time. And the point of retirement, or the 65th birthday, or the 60th birthday, or the 70th birthday, or some marker that is important to the parents, I think is a good time to start doing that sort of planning. And then I think the preparation for such a meeting or planning process begins with collecting information. The financial advisor, investment advisor, is an ideal person to provide a summary of what there is, because they usually know a lot about what there is. They may not know about things like real estate investments or family-owned businesses, but they know about the invested assets. And that data can be summarized and provided in reports so that people have access to them. Then I think the process includes getting waivers of confidentiality from the financial advisor and possibly from the attorney who's done the estate planning or is in the process of updating the estate plan, so that those individuals are comfortable knowing that they have their client's permission to share what would otherwise be private information that they're not allowed to share. Then I think some sort of agenda for the planning process needs to take place. What is the purpose? What is it the elders are willing to share in terms of information? What is the outcome that they want to see as a result of this planning? And if they are able to articulate that by themselves, that's great. But if they are not able to articulate that without help, then I would say getting somebody like one of us at AgingParents.com or some other trusted person to help them develop an agenda would be great. Then I think the next thing is to get meetings on the calendar and get people together and begin to communicate. And one of the fundamental steps in that communication process is really defining what the mission is. If the parents own things, do they want to see that used by their heirs for doing good in the world, for educating grandchildren, for creating a legacy of some kind that they define? Whatever the mission is becomes a primary part of the planning process and actually drives the action. And then once that is defined, I think the people involved in this go through deciding what the best outcome would look like and how to get there. And that would be it.
Let's talk about your book, which is The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents. Tell us what's in it and how it would be helpful in addressing maybe some of the issues that we're talking about here.
Sure. It's a basic book that I wrote in response to the fact that a lot of people were calling with questions, and some of these questions were redundant questions. And also, I looked at my background and what I know. I was a litigator for 27 years, and I represented people who had gotten injured, most of those people in car accidents. And some of those car accidents were caused by elderly drivers who shouldn't have been on the road. So the first chapter was how to handle a dangerous older driver. And then I go through a lot of other parts. There are 9 chapters, all of which are available separately. And we have it in audiobook, and we have it in PDF that's downloadable, and it's in print. It's on iTunes kind of thing. But we want people to have access to a reference book. All of the chapters are pretty short, but they give basic information. For example, there's a chapter on how to handle money for aging loved ones. And we talk about the durable power of attorney, what you can and can't do with it, why you need one, and what your obligations are if that becomes your job, to have that responsibility. So we cover a lot of different areas, but we cover them in a basic way so that if somebody doesn't understand anything about this and this job of being a caregiver or being in charge is thrust upon them, they will have some place to start.
And Carolyn, as we close, why don't you tell people about your website, where you blog? And once again, I'm going to mention the name of your book. It's called The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents, a help for those who are taking on the caregiver role in their lives. And that's by Carolyn Rosenblatt. And Carolyn, tell about your blog. You blog for Forbes. So if our listeners would like to follow the work and the issues you cover.
Sure. I was invited to blog on Forbes as a result of writing several articles for them. And the articles cover a lot of subjects that have to do with boomer issues. The blog is called Aging Parents, And Aging Parents covers not only issues that affect elders and those who love and care for them, but also there's another aspect, which is healthy aging. And that's my favorite, I think. That's the most fun part because I get to talk about exercise and nutrition and things that interest a nurse and things that interest a person like me who's very determined to have the healthiest possible senior years that I can. So that is it. Our website, agingparents.com, is designed to help people get information. First of all, the products that we have, which include the book and webinars. We have a YouTube channel, Aging Parents, and that gives little brief videos on things like what's a power of attorney or how do I talk to somebody with dementia. And my husband, the psychologist, Dr. Davis, and I both contribute to those. And we have a blog on our website, too, and it reflects sometimes the content that has been published on Forbes earlier. But really, it's a general information site, a place to get a consultation with experts in the field, and a place where people can purchase downloadable or print products as well.
Well, listen, Carolyn, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Very good information and issues. Once again, you know, the one great thing about our healthcare system is with knowledge, science, and the technological advances, we're living longer. But as a result of that, we're running into the very kind of issues that you and I were talking about.
That's right. And I think it's wonderful that you have a program that helps people access information in an easy way from someone with your knowledge. And I appreciate the opportunity to join you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. I hope you follow Carolyn's blog at Forbes.com because she deals with a lot of issues that we're seeing cropping up more and more today. And also, don't forget her book, The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents. In the meantime, well, we've run out of time. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for tuning in. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.